thinking of, let's say, for instance, let's say a triangle like this. You can come up with a mathematical system in which you don't really care about the length of the sides of a triangle, or the size of the triangle. You can invent a mathematical system in which the only thing you care about is the orientation of this triangle. Like, for instance, let's say I can call this A, B, and C. Okay? Well, I can describe the orientation of this triangle by, let's say, A, B, you know. And then if I rotate the triangle, you know, C takes the place of A takes the place of B, and B takes the place of C, you know, so that you have another orientation that you can describe. Now, this has nothing to do with numbers at all. See? And then you can make axes like this, you know. And you can rotate it like this, or flip it around, you know, like that, around these axes, you know. And then you get different positions. And a mathematical system like this has been developed, and many more similar to this. So this is just to point out that mathematics isn't all numbers. A lot of times, this sort of mathematics can be described with numbers. You know, I mean, it has a form that can be related to numbers. You know, and so with our knowledge of numbers that we have, we can associate these different orientations and so on and so forth. Another thing about, now this is only one example. There are many, many different examples. You can have a pentagon, you know, a hexagon, or any polygon. It doesn't have to be a triangle. And you can think of ways, you know, operations in which you can do this sort of thing. And then you can develop a nice, beautiful mathematics out of it. Now, another thing about mathematics is that it is true in its own right. In other words, it's circular. You know, you've heard of circular reasoning, you know, like Mary is the cook. You know, somebody asks, who's Mary? Mary is the cook. And somebody asks, who's the cook? Mary, you know. I mean, this is circular. Now, the problem, or the good thing about mathematics is that in spite of the fact that it's circular, it can be useful, you know. You can use circular reasoning to accomplish something. And many of you realize how important mathematics is today. It's just a process of circular reasoning, you know. And a lot of times when you talk about philosophy, for instance, you say, you're just going around in circles, you know, this sort of thing. Well, mathematicians admit that they're all circular reasoners. So, and also another thing about mathematics is that it has to start out with something, you know. I mean, when you're going to devise some sort of a system, you're going to have to start somewhere, and that something has to be undefined. In other words, you have to have some sort of feeling about it, you know. I mean, it's all common to every one of us, you know. Something that's real common to every one of us, even a little child can think of it. Well, this is where mathematicians would rather start and then develop their structure, you know, from it. Now, this basic starting point is usually called set theory, you know. Like, maybe this type of mathematics, for instance, can be started out by a set of orientations, you know, ABC, CBA, you know, and this sort of thing. You know, and then you flip it around, flop it around, and you have all possible orientations, and this is where we're going to start up, you know. And then the question, next, once we have defined our, well, not defined, but explained our where we're going to start, then we're going to have to decide what are we going to do with this set of collection, you know. Are we take two of these two elements, put them together, and you get something else. And maybe that something else will belong to that same set, you know. And then, and this is how you do things in mathematics. So from that point of view, mathematics is, you can't argue against mathematics from that point of view. It's right within its own right, you know, you can't argue, you know. And the problem comes when you try to apply mathematics to something. Mathematicians are very careful people. They try to do things precisely and very accurately and make sure that they don't make any wrong statements and this sort of thing. And so for that reason, I think mathematics is one of the most interesting disciplines in science. Now, when you get into physics, you apply mathematics. You have to begin with the fact that, okay, mathematicians are correct. You know, they got something that you can't deny, you know. And so the physicist's attitude toward mathematics is that it's something we can apply and something that we can't question at all, you know. I mean, it's right within its own right. Okay. Now, the difference between mathematics and physics is this. Physicists are more interested in finding general laws. And they make a statement about these general laws, you know. Like, for instance, the law of gravitation, the laws of electricity and magnetism, relativity, quantum atomic physics, quantum mechanics, and this sort of thing. They state these laws, and they find that most of the time, it turns out that they're wrong. You know, they're not like the mathematician. The physicist recognizes that what he says is not always true, but it's true most of the time. You know. And, I mean, what can the physicist do now, you know? I mean, if the statement that he makes is sometime going to be wrong, then why make the statement? Well, we're just going to have to start, you know, from what we have, you know. From that point of view, I think the physicist is a little humble, you know. He knows that he's going to be wrong. Somebody's going to come up and say, you know, you're all wet. But in the meantime, he's learned to be content with the general statements that he made. Now, how about the philosopher? I don't know too much about philosophy, but I do know a little bit. But a philosopher is much like the mathematician in that he's always trying to make correct statements. And he is very careful, you know, he analyzes, you know, carefully, and he devises a set of a logical system in which he can make his statements, guide his statements with, you know, this sort of thing. But when you study the history of science, you find that the role that the physicist plays turns out to be not making the statements like a philosopher, but rather correcting the philosopher. You know, the physicist can make statements, you know, and the philosopher does make statements, but a lot of times it turns out that the physicist makes statements that contradicts or seems to contradict the statements of the philosopher, you know. And then also philosophy talks about beauty, good, bad, and this sort of thing, which is pretty much impossible to really, you know, contradict from a physicist's point of view. And so while the philosopher is a little bit more open, you know, he deals with a lot more things. So that's the opening statement that I'd like to make. Now, one good thing about science is that whenever he makes a statement, a general statement, he has to check it with experimentation. I mean, some theoretician comes up and say this is so and that's true and so on, okay, then the experimentalist will set up his scientific apparatus to see if that theoretician is right. A lot of times he finds that the theoretician was right, and the experimentalist finds that he can add to, you know, the statements of the theoretician. In other words, there's a dualism here. You know, there's a theoretician that's doing the guessing, speculation, and this sort of thing, and then the experimentalist verifying his statements, you know. And then the backward thing can happen too. I said that the experimentalist has to verify the theoretician, and that's the role he does. Well, actually, it sometimes goes the other way around. The experimentalist can go on experimenting without any reason at all, just for sheer enjoyment, I suppose. You know, he can do experiments on this field, experiments, you know, just for the sake of doing experiments, finding out empirical data. You know, and then the theoretician would take a look at this set of data and see if he can make some sort of a sense out of it. You know, and a lot of times he does. You know, and that's what makes science what it is. It's a dual process in which the experimentalist and the theoretician work together to accomplish what they have accomplished. I'd like to read a little bit of what I'm sure many of you have heard of Richard Feynman, one of our greatest theoretical physicists in our time. He's now a professor of theoretical physics at California Institute of Technology. And here's what he said about how to go about finding a new law. And he says something there that what science is. I'll read it. In general, we look for a new law by the following process. First, we guess it. Then we compute the consequences of the guess to see what would be implied if this law were guessed is right. Then we compare the result of the computation to nature with experiment or experience, compare it directly with observation to see if it works. If it disagrees with experiment, it is wrong. In that simple statement is the key to science. It does not make any difference how beautiful your guess is. It does not make any difference how smart you are, who made the guess, or what is his name. If it disagrees with experiment, it is wrong. That is all there is to it. It is true that one has to check a little to make sure what it is wrong, because whoever did the experiment may have reported incorrectly, or there may have been some feature in the experiment that was not noticed, some dirt or something. Or the man who computed the consequences, even though it may have been the one who made the guess, would have made some mistakes in the analysis. There are obvious remarks. So, when I say if it disagrees with experiments, it is wrong. I mean after the experiment has been checked, the calculations have been checked, and the thing has been rubbed back and forth a few times to make sure that the consequences are logical consequences from the guesses, and in that fact it disagrees with a very careful checked experiment. So he has some sort of a feeling about the processes by which scientists make their discoveries. And I'd like to sort of, in this little scheme that I've written on the board, I'm taking a sort of a historical approach, and you'll find that throughout this, that you'll, this principle of being applied, you know, the experimentalists and the theoretician working hand in hand and learning more about the same thing, keeping in mind at the same time that what they're finding is someday going to be thrown down to the ground, you know, and something new will come. So this is how science works. Okay, now I'm going to start with, well, I was supposed to speak on modern physics, but in order to get a feel of what modern physics is, we have to compare it with something. So I'm going to compare it with classical mechanics, classical physics. Now, classical physics ended about in the year 1900, and it began in the year about 1650. Now, during that time, there were a lot of speculations about the universe, you know, for instance, the planets, how they moved, how things dropped to the ground, this sort of thing. And it was all speculation, and nobody really knew exactly what was going on. So there was a Danish astronomer called Tycho Brahe that decided to see if he can gather up a whole bunch of data, you know, about the movement of the planets. You know, there were eight planets found at that time, and he was interested in their exact location and position, you know, at different times of the year, you know. And so what he did was he took his telescope and he pointed at that angle. He wrote down the time and he figured out how far away it was and this sort of thing. Okay, that's Mars. And he kept track of it all year round, you know. I mean, he knew where it was at all times. And he did the same with Jupiter and the other planets, you know, and this sort of thing. So all he had was a mess of data that didn't make sense at all to anybody. All anybody knew was their exact location and so on. You know. So then along came a German, I guess he was an astronomer, yeah, a German astronomer named Kepler that decided to see if he can make sense out of this mess of data that his teacher, well, Kepler was a student of Tycho Brahe. Well, Kepler was a little bit more enthusiastic about science, and he decided to make some sense out of it. And he succeeded partially. Well, first of all, he found that here's the sun, you know, and here's the Earth. Here's Mars, you know, and then there's Venus, and then there's Mercury, and all the other planets, and so on and so forth. And he found that they approximated a curve called the ellipse, you know, an elliptical orbit. At first, people thought it was circular, you know, circle is something more nicer to have in nature, so people automatically thought it was circular. But it turned out that it was more elliptical than circular. And then another thing that Kepler did out of the mess of data that Tycho Brahe had was, let me take for example only one planet. I don't know, I don't care which one it is, but let's say the Earth. I put it over here, kind of exaggerated, just to show that it's an ellipse, you know, it's squished on this side and elongated on this side, and here's the sun, you know, and here's the Earth. It's exaggerated, but that's how it is. And he found that, let's say, for instance, at this point, let's say, June, and then 1 month later, let's say, the Earth was over here, July. Okay. And, I don't know, he was just messing around, trying to find some sort of order in this sort of thing. And he decided to, okay, I'll find the area of this, you know. So he calculated the area. I want to explain how he did it. It requires a little mathematics. But he found the area of this, okay, he wrote it down. And then sometime later on, at the same time, let's say a month later over here, August. Okay, and he figured out the area right here, you know. And to his bewilderment, it turned out that this area here was equivalent to that area, you know. Well, he actually made sense, some sense out of it, but he still was quite perplexed about it. Well, he did this over and over again. It turned out that it remained true, you know. I mean, this is what happens. Another thing that he discovered was the following. Okay, well, he decided to, okay, I'll measure the distance, the long axis of the orbit here of the Earth, you know. And he found that it was related to the time it took for the Earth to go around in one whole revolution, you know, and it turned out to be the relationship was that the distance d was equal to some constant times the square root of t cubed, where t is the time, the total time for the Earth to go around the Sun, and d is the distance of the longest axis. That's how he discovered those two things. But he, you know, I mean, so what? Big deal, you know. At least there's some sort of, I mean, he made some sense out of it, but he was still quite perplexed. K is some sort of a constant inserted to make the equality right. A lot of times when physicists don't know what else to do, they usually put a little constant on there to make that equality okay. But the important thing is, though, that this is what's important right here. The square root of the t cubed is what's important. And that's what makes it sensible. At least a little bit more sensible. It's not just a bunch of data. It's now something like that. Okay? Now, right about that same era, about, I don't know, 1670, I'm just guessing, a man called Galileo was messing around like what Kepler was doing. What Galileo was doing was, see, he erected an inclined plane, and he was rolling balls down, you know, and measuring how long it took, you know, and this sort of thing. And he was just messing around, gathering empirical data. He says that if it's steeper, it's going to fall down faster. If it's, you know, this sort of thing. Wrote down a whole bunch of numbers about these things. He was not only doing that, he was dropping balls out of the leaning tower of Pisa, or I guess that's what it's called, you know, and measuring the time it took. And one of the things he found out was that a body, whether it's heavy or light, always falls at the same rate and this sort of thing. Okay. Now, also, during that time, there were a lot of minor scientists that were making measurements like this, you know. People were taking bicycle wheels and turning them, and how much force does it take to make it turn so fast, and this sort of thing. And, well, not bicycles. I'm sure bicycles in those times weren't invented, but wheels, you know. They were spinning them and this sort of thing. Well, there were a lot of things going on like that, and nobody really knew exactly what to do with all this stuff. It still didn't make any sense at all. Now, then along came Newton. And Newton is deemed as one of the greatest scientists has ever lived, at least in the field of physics. And what he did was he discovered three laws that can explain the whole works. It doesn't matter whether the person was talking about the planetary motion or things rolling down inclined planes or things dropping down to the ground. He compiled the whole set of messy data and put it all in one group in which there were three statements. I'll write down some of these statements. And that's what's so interesting about physics, is that you can incorporate a lot of messy stuff into something rather simple. Now, one of those laws was that two bodies, let's say M1 and M2, with mass M1 and mass M2, with a distance r apart, are going to attract each other according to the following formula. Force is equal to M1 M2 over r squared, and then, like I explained, they always have to put some sort of a constant to make the equality okay. Okay, what was important was this thing right here. You know, if you double the distance between the two, the amount of force is going to be 1/4 of what it was, you know, and so on. Now, I'm not going to tell you how Newton came up with it. It just came out of his head, you know. That's how much of a genius Newton was. Well, in that time he was very ingenious. Another thing, Galileo was playing with this sort of thing too, you know. Here you have, you throw a ball, you know, it'll continue in that same direction forever and ever. If there's no frictional forces or any other forces involved, you know. That's one of the laws of nature. And let's see, what's the other law? Another law was that for every action there is an equal and opposite reaction. In other words, if I fired a gun, you know, the bullet's going to go that way and I'm going to get a little kick, you know. So Newton showed to the scientific community that all you really need to know is these three things to explain everything, you know. But then someone came along, not quite everything. So that's another era in history where scientists actually, at that time, thought that Newton had discovered all the laws that there was really to discover. I mean, all we had to do is work out the mathematics and the details and so on and so forth. That's all that the university. But Maxwell, at the same time, was working not with particles, you know, mass, masses, and this sort of thing. He was playing around with electricity and magnetism. One of his co-workers was Faraday, Michael Faraday. Faraday noted that that if a charged particle was boosted over this way at a certain velocity, then it will emit an electrical force over this way and a magnetic force over that way. And he was able to measure the electricity and magnetism. Now, he couldn't explain why. But But he explained how. And that's all there was to it. You know, I mean, the silly thing just happens. There's no, I mean, all we do is observe it. And so then he was playing around with magnets, and he was measuring their strength and how far the thing had to be, you know, to be attracted to the magnet and, well, the iron, you know, this sort of thing. And he was making all sorts of measurements, and he explained everything in lines of force. And see, here's a magnet right here. Yeah. Here's a magnetic lines of force. He was the one that invented magnetic lines of force. You know. These lines were very close together, close to the magnet, and became further and further apart, further away it went, you know, and it can go on to infinity, you know. Okay, and so here again was Faraday observing all this silly thing going on, you know, and so along came Maxwell to see if he can make some sort of a sense out of it, you know. Now, one thing wrong with Maxwell was that he was a mathematician. And so he was a pretty hard guy to communicate with. Now here, Faraday was working with concrete things, you know, we can picture these things. But here Maxwell was a sort of a genius that would rather explain things in terms of mathematics. And that's why he was so hard to communicate with. Well, anyhow, what he did was he incorporated these electrical laws and magnetic laws and wrote down equations, you know, and this sort of thing. And he bungled up all this in one. Now, how is what Maxwell found out related to Newton? Well, it turned out that there were a lot of contradictions. I told you a little while ago that physicists actually thought in that time that there were all the laws there was ever to discover, and the mathematics had to be worked out. Well, there were a lot of, now that Maxwell and Faraday had studied this phenomena of electricity and magnetism, people had a hard time trying to put them together in one bundle, you know. And there were contradictions here and there and everywhere, and everybody, in that time, physicists were getting pretty arrogant, and Maxwell came along and they all fell flat on their faces. And out of this conflict between Newton and Maxwell came modern physics. Now, modern physics also originated quite independently with Einstein. Einstein wasn't really talking about magnetism and electricity and this sort of thing. He was more concerned with time and space. Now, physicists in those days had some sort of intuitive idea about distance, time, size, you know, and this sort of thing. And they all thought, well, this is all obvious and intuitive. There's no question about it. You know, it's really easy to perceive it, really to think of it. It's really easy to think of it, you know. But Einstein challenged what physicists always had thought to be common sense. Now, I'm not, or anybody else is in any position to explain how Einstein came up with some of his ideas about space and time, but they do work. That's the main important thing. See? Actually, there were very few people that really understood, or maybe there are, and those who said that they did understand Einstein, or probably weren't quite sure too. But one of our greatest theoretical physicists, Richard Feynman, is first to say that he doesn't understand relativity. There was only one man in history that understood relativity, and that's Einstein. So a lot of times when a genius comes along and we see that his ideas work, then that's really what we have to do is just accept it, you know. He may give a whole book on a philosophical treatise on how the thing works, you know. But after reading through all that, you're still more confused over the whole thing. And so this is how we students operate, you know. Just have to accept certain things and maybe someday understand it, you know. Pardon? Who does? Oh, okay. Yeah, well, I think that happens in other areas too, you know. Although, well, see, also Einstein's theories are beginning to break down at this time, you know. I'll talk about that a little bit later. But anyhow, Einstein challenged some of the basic intuitive ideas that we had, and absolutely, you know, disagreed with some of the basic things. Like, for instance, if we have a train here, you know, a train going about, let's say, 40 miles an hour in this direction, and then you stand on here and shoot a bullet, let's say, at 60 miles an hour, you know. So, intuitively, I mean logically, in fact, logically, I suppose, the velocity of the bullet with respect to the ground will be 100 miles an hour because 40 plus 60 is 100. Well, Einstein challenged this. Would you believe it? Well, actually, it was a result of something else that he challenged. But this is what actually happened, is that if you have a, let's say, a rocket ship going, let's say, I don't know, 20,000 miles an hour, and then shine a flashlight from your rocket ship, and light goes 186,000 miles a second, so the velocity of that light has to be 20,000 miles an hour plus 186,000 miles a second. You know, this is, seems logically, I mean, intuitively correct. But it turns out that from experiment, that the velocity of light remains constant no matter what, you know, whether the source of light is coming toward you or away from you, it's still the same, you know. Now, how in the world, you know, are you going to believe this, you know? I mean, this is experimental evidence, you know. We base everything on experiment. That's all there is to it. Well, Einstein explained, unfortunately, again, with mathematics, and it's pretty darn hard for especially students like me to really understand. But what Einstein did was he applied a new type of mathematics called Riemannian mathematics, Riemannian geometry. It's a type of geometry that Riemann invented, a man called Riemann. I guess he was a German too. Notice that a lot of these people are German, would you believe? And there are a lot more group of scientists that are German, and I really can't understand it. I mean, you know, there are some Danish people, and Bohr was Danish, wasn't he? Yeah. How about de Broglie? I don't know. Well, it doesn't make it. It's really irrelevant. Well, anyhow. See, what was I saying? Oh, Einstein applied this new type of geometry. Now, by the way, the geometry that he applied is this. Now, if this angle is equal to that angle, Euclid would say that these two lines are parallel and that these two lines will never meet. Now, this is one of the things that he postulated. Euclid says he never proved it from the basic stuff, you know. He couldn't. Nobody was able to prove it at all. I mean, for years and hundreds of years, people have tried to prove it and with no avail at all. And so what Riemann did, okay, if we can't prove it, why don't we start out with the fact that they do need, you know. I mean, let's see what happens if we say that two parallel lines mean over here and over here, you know. I mean, this is kind of ridiculous, you know. At first, this is what the reaction of some mathematicians and physicists, people, ordinary people, reacted. I mean, this is ridiculous. Of course they don't meet, you know. But he said, okay, if we start out with the fact that they do meet, we'll come up with something different, okay? And this is what he did. He erected a whole new set of mathematics, which seemingly had no application at all until Einstein came along. And Einstein applied this type of mathematics to incorporate a whole nest of things that he stated, you know, and it all depended on this sort of mathematics, you know. I mean, it's applicable, you know. Like, one of the results of this type of mathematics is the shortest distance between two points is not a straight line, but a curve, some sort of a curve, you know, this sort of thing. And also, to be able to better understand this, you and I have grown up in a Euclidean world, you know. I mean, ever since we were yay high, we said things look like the floor is flat, the straight line is the shortest distance between two points. And so we grew up with this, and it's embedded in our mind. We've been brainwashed from nature, I mean, from childhood. So it's hard for us to take this sort of thing, you know. And Riemann was one of those few mathematicians that was able to forget about his basic intuitive ideas about the Euclidean world and say, okay, I'll reject this and see what happens. And it turns out that he came up with something very beautiful, and not only very beautiful, but also applicable. Okay. So, I'm not going to state, for lack of time, all of Einstein's work. I mean, you know, his statements. I mean, I don't understand Einstein. All I know, all I can do is be able to state some of his statements, which are quite startling. In fact, this is how modern physics is right now. As opposed to classical physics, a common sense physics, it's a startling physics in that experiments show something that we think our common sense is not true at all, you know. I mean, okay, next comes Schrödinger. Schrödinger, of course, was a German. And before he, about 30 years before his time, people were studying atomic physics. There were quite a whole group of scientists studying this light rays bending through refraction, you know, and they were recording all this data and this sort of thing, writing down a whole mess of numbers, and somebody else was trying to make some sort of sense out of this data. And it wasn't until Bohr came along and de Broglie that they succeeded a little bit. But right now I'm going to talk about Thomson. Thomson was one of our failures in physics, in atomic physics, in that he proposed a picture of the atom that couldn't be verified. Now, for instance, his picture of the atom was a positively charged sphere in which electrons were smeared out all around it. And it was spherical, because spheres seems to be the nicer shape, you know. And the reason why he said that the atom was like this is that it's neutral. It doesn't have a charge. But a positive charge and a negative electron smeared all over it will put together, will become a neutral atom. What was wrong with this model was that it couldn't predict anything. You know, while Newton's model of the universe, let's say for instance the gravitation predicted something, so it was, you know, okay. But what was wrong with Thomson's model was that it couldn't predict anything. Then along came Rutherford. I'll put Rutherford over here. Rutherford, okay, Thomson was all wet, and he was just speculating and this sort of thing. I'll see if I can do something. So what he did was he took a gold foil, say over here, you know, a thin sheet of gold foil, and then bombarded it with alpha particles, you know, and then he put detectors behind here, all over, right here, you know, some sort of electronic detectors, that if these alpha particles could pass through the gold foil, it hits here, the detector will detect it, and maybe you have a little dial over here that if it, the alpha particle hits it, the little needle will go this way, you know, and this sort of thing. Well, that's what Rutherford did. And it turned out that, statistically speaking, most of the alpha particles went right through and hit. Most of them were here. And very few of them went this way, you know. They hit and bounced off. They hit and bounced off, you know. And the conclusion that Rutherford made was that the atom wasn't like the way Thomson explained, but rather it had a very tiny nucleus surrounded by electrons. And the size of the nucleus was very, very small compared to the size of the whole atom. Because from his experiment, he found that since most of them went through, and only a small number of them were deflected, that the only conclusion that he came to was that the nucleus was very, very small, you know. And so that was a good experimental starting point. And this seems rather logical and, you know, nice. And so at that time, Bohr decided to do something kind of naive. He said, okay, we know something about planetary motion from Newton and Kepler and all those guys. Why don't we look at the atom as though it were in planetary motion? So he did calculations, he figured out the orbits of the electrons and this sort of thing. And he came up with something that agrees with experiments. You know, I've mentioned all these experiments about spectroscopy, how electrons were emitted and this sort of thing. And he incorporated all this in the picture of the atom in which the electrons went around in orbits like planets. But there was one strange thing about his model, was that it was experimentally concluded that here's the nucleus, here's the electrons. They were only allowed to go in certain prescribed orbit. Now, in classical mechanics, you have any planet can have any orbit, you know. I mean, it depends on its energy, you know. But Bohr found that the electrons can only have certain prescribed orbits. And the reason, he didn't know. You know, I mean, it's just the way nature works. You know. And that, till this day, nobody really knows, and philosophers have tried to explain it in terms of their own philosophy, and it's a lot of speculation, you know. But that's how nature is. And one of the other things that happens is that energy comes only in bundles. Now, most of us have some intuitive idea about continuity, like things are described in continuous nature, you know, are all continuous. I mean, energy can have any value and this sort of thing. Well, it turned out that Einstein stated, Einstein was also working on this sort of thing, he says that energy can only have observed in certain bundles, you know. And that really contradicted some of our intuitive ideas about energy. It can only come in bundles. And then a man called de Broglie made another naive statement. Was this. Now, during that time, there were a lot of experimentalists that were observing particles, except that these particles behaved like waves. Now, that's kind of ridiculous. But this is, he was actually, experimentalists were, you know, there were crystals, atomic crystals at that time, you know, with these atoms nicely arranged like this, you know. And electron, supposedly a mass particle, was directed into here, and then here's a detector over here. Then the electron landed in only prescribed positions, you know, in exactly the same way as waves are detracted. In fact, they use the same equation, exactly the same mathematical equation. And so from that point of view, particles were waves, you know. This is kind of ridiculous, you know. But so what de Broglie did was he said, okay, I'll accept that particles are waves. In fact, what I'll do is this. I'm going to, and energy of a particle can be stated like this, 1/2 mv². You know. Velocity of a particle is the m is its mass, and then its energy is going to be the whole thing right here. Okay? But experimentalists also found that E is equal to hv. Now, h is one of those constants that physicists have to, you know, insert in there to make the equation true. Okay? This is also true, you know, for n, a number n, an integer, you know. So what he did was he equated these two and solved for v in terms of n, you know. And then, so a particle can not only have, can't have any, just any velocity, it has to have a certain discrete velocity, you know. And so de Broglie made his little model in which all these electrons were not mass particles, but they were little wavy stuff going around like that, you know. That's kind of ridiculous. You can't even picture it, hardly, but this is the only way you can picture it. But then along came, I'm trying to go fast here, but I go into more detail to make explain it a little bit more. But then along came Frazier. Now, Schrödinger was a philosopher to begin with. He wanted to be a philosopher. He was, however, very intrigued by this sort of silly things happening, and he also was a mathematician. And one of his specialties was waves, you know, mathematics of waves. And seemingly out of the clear blue sky, he proposed an equation that will incorporate all masses and all waves and this sort of thing into one equation, you know. And this one equation, experimentalists found worked, you know. It works. And that was its only, it's true because it works. You know, it predicts experimental data, you know, just out of the clear blue sky seemingly. And the reason I say just out of the clear blue sky seemingly is that a lot of people don't really know exactly how he came up with that equation. You know, they're still wondering how it works. And I guess that's what makes a genius what he is. Comes up with something out of the clear blue sky and makes a statement, and he can't explain why, you know. And that's how geniuses work, I guess.
About
1930. Yeah. So. Then another man came around, like for instance Heisenberg. Heisenberg developed the same thing, except with a different type of mathematics. You know. He was. What he did was he came to the mathematicians after doing his work. He came to a bunch of mathematicians and he said, "Have you ever heard of this sort of algebra, you know, a non-commutative algebra?" He explained how it is, you know, it has certain properties, you know. I mean, he thought he invented a certain mathematics. And it turned out that the mathematicians had discovered this 100 years back, you know. I mean, some oddball had invented this sort of mathematics, and it was begging for it the last time around 100 years. And it turned out that this type of mathematics can explain, you know, same thing that Schrödinger did. You know. And so that's the relationship, I guess, between mathematics. I guess you have some sort of a feeling of the relationship between mathematics and physics, in that mathematics is applicable to physics. No. His co-worker.
Yes.
I mean, he was a theoretician and a philosopher. A lot of these scientists were, especially in modern science, were philosophers. I didn't name a lot of these people that did their work. There's Leibniz, who invented the calculus. Well, Newton invented that too, except that he did it in a different way. He was more interested in applying, describing nature than Leibniz. Leibniz was more interested in mathematics than his mathematics for its own sake. But it turned out that these two were doing the same thing. You know. So it's really interesting, you know, just thinking about the conceptual development of physics and how it started with people and how we have to discard our common sense. You know. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things also, the aftermath of this crazy thing going on was that the scientists, having experienced something from history, was that philosophers have a tendency to take their findings, physics findings, and use it in their own philosophies, you know, to back their own philosophy. Well, what they did was they met in Copenhagen, Denmark. And they all got together. Okay, we're gonna explain it our own way. We're gonna have our own philosophical explanation. You know, and they came up with a Copenhagen interpretation. That's called a Copenhagen interpretation of their results. And they came up with the fact that things don't have. Like for instance, if I drop a marble on the floor, the reason why it drops is not because of the law, but because it has a high probability of dropping, you know, a very, very high probability. Now that came out of de Broglie and Heisenberg, you know. He came up with the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, you know. That was only one of the interpretations, one phase of the interpretation. There was a whole bunch of other stuff. Then the philosophers came around and said, okay, we're going to interpret the philosophical interpretation of the Copenhagen interpretation. In other words, okay, we're going to interpret what the physicists interpreted, you know. I mean, that's kind of interesting. So,
I think I can define a different mindset.
One thing you have to keep in mind, now the scientist, you know, the physicist always knows that he's wrong. Somebody's always going to come up with the fact that he's wrong. But he's only approaching the truth, whatever it is. And that's the attitude the physicist has. He doesn't care about the ultimate truth. All he cares about is the truth that appeals to him right now, you know. Yeah. So, maybe that's one good thing I like about physics is that it doesn't claim to know the ultimate truth. Instead, it says, we can do something to approach it anyway.
That's